This is Rabbi G, and welcome to Harvard God and Gen Z. The goal of this podcast is to discuss life's big questions with some of America's brightest young minds. We will discuss Harvard's continued sway on the imagination as the peak of success. We will discuss how to get there and what it is like when you do. We will then shift to discuss if and in what ways meaning and God are relevant features of Gen Z. What better place than Harvard for discussing these issues with the thought leaders of tomorrow?
Welcome back, everybody. We're very excited to have on this episode Sandy Koenig, senior from right around the Washington, D.C. area. Senior in Harvard, Washington, not surprisingly, in Washington, D.C., not even the area, majoring in history, was former chair of the Harvard Political Union, and we're very excited to have him here today to discuss things maybe relevant to politics, maybe not. We'll see how it goes, but welcome, Sandy. How are you today?
Hello. Hi, Rabbi Yoni. It's great to be here. I'm doing great, and I'm just very excited for this conversation. Thanks for having me on.
Wonderful. Thank you for coming. So tell me a little bit about yourself. Did you grow up in a very academically driven family? How did you end up at Harvard University?
I don't know. I suppose academically driven is a good way to put it. I wouldn't say it was a super, you know, high pressure environment or something like that, but definitely, you know, I always appreciated that my parents were interested in talking about intellectual things and, you know, interested in learning and studying and books. It's a big books household. We were always, you know.
What kind of books were in your house? Any of them stick out?
Oh, I mean, a huge variety. I mean, I always laugh because if you ever come to my house, it's just books everywhere. Like, we don't really have enough bookcases. So, like, you know, books on the floor, books in stacks. It's kind of funny. But I don't know.
And you felt that that really influenced you as a kid, seeing all the books and seeing that, being in that environment?
Definitely. And one of those things that I've noticed a lot, and this is definitely, you know, there are no hard and fast rules when it comes to these things, but there's definitely, I think, a high distribution of people who did not watch very much television as kids among Harvard students. I definitely among that category. My parents, particularly my mom, was resolutely opposed to television when I was a little kid.
She's a smart lady, I can tell you that. No question about it. So how did she limit television time? What were the rules?
We just didn't watch television. Like, that was, yeah, like, there was very little.
You weren't allowed to? There was no television in the house? How was that enforced?
We had and still have, although it has been upgraded in the last 22 years, but we have one television in the house. And I mean, we use it for like major things, but yeah, we just weren't allowed.
And I don't know. Did you sneak off to friends' houses to watch TV, or you just, what became
part of your life? Yeah, at friends' houses. Yeah, at friends' houses. I guess I sort of, I don't know. This is, by the time I got older, definitely, you know, you'd watch television, you'd watch things as they, you know, like, they weren't super strict about it going on. But like, when I was really little, when I was, you know, like 2-3 years old, like, you're not really going to friends' houses to watch TV, I guess. I just, like, you know, we just didn't watch television. So, and I don't know, incredible. I think that had an effect.
That's a phenomenal idea. And I think it does set up a beautiful environment. And I always love that, in, you know, many Jewish households, the center of the house is the bookshelf. And as we know, in many other households, the center of the house is that flat screen. And I think it does communicate subliminally a big message.
Yeah, and definitely, yeah, that good point about the placement too, because, you know, having it out of the way, not in a central location, makes a big difference, I think, in just how central it is. Like, you just have to sort of, it's like, oh, like, this is something we need to use the television, you know, use the TV for, and we're gonna go and watch TV there, instead of it being something that you just sort of turn on without thinking. And I mean, you know, there are costs. There are definitely costs. When I was really little, like, you know, I hadn't seen SpongeBob. And so, like, you know, there's,
I'm not sure that's a cost,
Sandy.
I think that might be a tremendous gain.
It's a social cost for a young person. But, but
you should know something, Sandy. I'll just share with you a really cool idea. Just, you mentioned that the word in great for, in Judaism, for a crown is called a zer, is called a crown. Hmm. interestingly, it shares the same root as the word czar, which means strange. That often greatness comes with strange behavior. For example, a story is that one of my rabbis likes to share is that there was a kid in his class growing up who always woke up at 6 a.m, only ate carrots and cottage cheese, and they thought she was the strangest person. It turned out, of course, she was an Olympic swimmer, so therefore she had a very strict diet and a very disciplined lifestyle. So that was his example of sometimes strangeness creates greatness. And so, yes, maybe you're a little strange for not snowing SpongeBob, but look where you are today.
Well, I don't want to put myself in any particularly strange categories because I don't know if I'm as great as the Olympic swimmers and those people of the world. But I think it's so interesting that there's a Jewish connection and a Hebrew connection there, because I've also noticed, like, if you look at the really incredible people, like, you know, the people like, you know, the Steve Jobs and the Bill Gates and the Elon Musks of the world who are, you know, doing crazy things, or like, you know, various other, you know, if anyone ever talks to me about politics, we'll get to politics, I'm sure, at some point, you know, big Lyndon Johnson fan, like the Lyndon Johnsons of the world, like people who are really successful and do, like, you know, not like just regular successful, but like crazy successful, are weird. They're just weird. Like, they have really weird behaviors. And I just think it's like, there's part of that, like going, you know, part of that, just doing something different and like just being comfortable, just like doing different stuff than other people, that contributes to that.
100%. Totally agree. And it probably has to be so that if you want to set a new vision for the world, you can't be of the world. You have to be slightly outside of the world in order to shape it differently. So I always find it interesting that quite a few students actually that I've spoken to did not have tiger moms and dads on top of them, making sure they get to Harvard, blah, blah, blah. Now you're telling me that, yeah, at least you had a bit of a subliminal environment that was more intellectually oriented. So therefore, obviously getting to Harvard is not a simple thing. So what was the motivation for you? Obviously it had to come from more from within you. How did you stay motivated that's what you wanted, that you wanted to work hard in high school, not get caught up in distractions, social life, but to focus and accomplish something?
I would say I was really lucky, because, and not necessarily lucky as in just like total random chance, but lucky as in I think I had a good environment. And definitely agree, like my parents were never very high pressure about these things. You know, they took school seriously, but it was not an environment where I needed to feel pressure to perform, or I was going to get yelled at, or, you know, something like that. So like, you know, And I always appreciated that. And they never, I feel like in high school, especially, like I was very interested in a lot of things, and I pursued a lot of things that I was interested in. I had a best friend, one of my best friends to this day, in high school, we started a club about military and political strategy. Like, this was not like a college oriented thing. This was just like, we liked to talk about it and we wanted to do this. And so like, you know, in sophomore year, we started this club and we just sort of had meetings and, you know, talked about random historical events.
People came to this?
Yeah, well, you know, we roped most of our friends to coming, plus like a couple other members who were actually interested. And it was just a great time. And I think I was lucky to also go to a school where, you know, I felt like I had the opportunity to like pursue my intellectual interests. And I felt like I didn't really think that hard about the college process until junior year of high school. Like I wasn't somebody who really structured my whole my whole high school life around thinking about colleges or thinking about what college I wanted to go to. But I was very interested in school and I did really well because
just natural curiosity.
Yeah, I think there was a sort of natural curiosity, and just like, you know, I think the thing that helped me was the thing that helped me was my own sense that I had to do work well. Like when it was senior spring, my friends kind of made fun of me because I was still like actually doing schoolwork in high school, because I don't know. There's something that just like, I was sort of incapable of not like, of just like completely doing nothing. Like you feel some sort of responsibility to like, to your family, to your teachers, to like do good work. And so like that helped too.
And And would you say it's a pride thing? You're saying it's not a pride thing, but more of a dignity thing and just giving respect to the people that are teaching you and to yourself.
Respect, definitely. And pride, I think, is there too. Like, it's like, I do, you know, like, I want to feel like I do good work. And so, like, I feel the urge to do that.
All right. So you end up at Harvard. Well, that was an exciting moment for you when you got in.
Oh, definitely.
You end up in Harvard, and was the experience of going to Harvard, did it live up to its name?
I think the experience of going to Harvard is a little bit different than maybe the popular imagination, although it definitely lives up in some ways to the sort of the reputation, in the sense that it's a pretty cool place. I certainly, when you're a freshman or when you first come in, there's this sort of sense of awe and wonder at like all the possibilities that are ahead of you. And I mean, to this day, I always say, like, you know, every semester you get to pick four classes. There are 2,000 to choose from. So there are a lot of options that are in front of you that you can choose. So a lot of cool things. You know, Harvard has 40 something concentrations, which is what we call the majors, and 40 something languages that you can learn, and 40 something sports that you can play. So like, there's a lot of stuff going on, which is, I think, one of the coolest things about it. But on the flip side, it's very self-driven. You know, like, looking back as a senior, I would say, like, the thing that Harvard does, like, no matter how much they tell you that they're supporting you, one of the best things that Harvard teaches you is really how to run your own life, because they sort of throw you in and they're like, 2,000 classes, here you go, pick them, good luck. Lots of clubs, you know, 1,000 student organizations, just like, figure it out.
Sounds overwhelming.
And that's sort of part of what, and it is a little overwhelming as when you're an incoming student, but the beauty of it is, like, there's so many opportunities and there's so many cool people,
right?
That, you know, that's, I think those are the biggest benefits.
So now you're on the way out of Harvard. How have you changed by being there?
This is one of those questions that I think about once in a while. It's tough. It's tough to say. It's tough to say for yourself. I think I've certainly become more reflective about myself and about where I want to go in life, and about
some something Harvard passions. Taught you, or something they think just being in college and maturing taught you?
Yeah, I think some of it is just sort of being in college and just being able to meet all these new people and talk to them who have such different experiences and come from such different places. And looking back, you know, sometimes I look back at the courses that I took. I'm like, wow, those were really interesting. You know, like, I was just filing this semester. We have to file. So Harvard is weird in many ways. Harvard has its own way of doing everything, which I always make fun of. And one of those is that you have to apply to graduate. Like, you don't graduate. You get to senior year and they're like, okay, you need to file an application to graduate and prove to the university.
Never ends. The rat race never ends. Huh?
literally, like, you have to prove to the university that you have satisfied the academic requirements that they have set out. They don't verify it for you. You have to, like, show them. So in the course of doing this, I get, you know, it gives you a chance to look back at all the courses that you've taken. And I got to look back at all my courses, and it was more interesting than I had remembered, you know, which is always a good feeling.
Any piece of knowledge that you learned change your life in some way, or what sticks out when you say something interesting? What does that mean? Just a fun fact, like something that you find on a Snapple bottle, or it's an insight that changes the way you look at things.
I'm not sure it takes the specific position of an insight or something like that, but just sort of looking back and seeing that I took a pretty broad variety of interesting courses.
And tell me, the students at Harvard, you found the atmosphere, people are generally happy, fulfilled, stressed, anxious, unfulfilled. What was your impression?
Well, I think, if I recall, I think you asked this question to Matthew Miller when he was on as well. And I think he answered in a way that's relatively similar to me. I think, you know, one of the things that's in your head when you come is that people are going to be very competitive and very, like, hostile when you go to Harvard. And largely, that was not my experience. I think people are incredibly friendly and kind and helpful. in almost every respect. I think below the surface, there people are very stressed. And I think it would be wrong. And one of the things that I think actually, one of the things that I learned pretty early on, luckily, that has helped me a lot, and that a lot of people should keep in mind, because I think this affects almost everyone, is that if you think you're stressed and feeling imposter syndrome and struggling, and everyone else around you is doing great and they're thriving and they're getting A's and they're, you know, killing all their papers and their PSETs and their assignments, like, it's just not how it is. You know, mm-hmm. everyone feels the way you do. And in fact, there are probably people who feel worse than you, who feel more like an imposter, feel more like they don't deserve to be there, because every person at Harvard, and I think this is true in any sort of high achieving place, like pretty much everyone worries sometimes that they don't deserve to be there, they don't belong there. And it, you know, it hits them in their, you know, their self-confidence. And so like to be able to, and for me, it's always helpful to think that like, and when I doubt myself, that like there are other people who are also feeling those things, and they're going through it too. And if they look so good, then presumably I'm doing okay too.
Yep, that's a classic psychological benefit of universalizing that I'm not alone. You know, I'm not the only one struggling here. My problems are not unique. And then for some reason, that's an very comforting thought for many people. Did you grow up with any spiritual life, or were you guys strictly secular and the spiritual realm didn't really come across in your family?
I definitely grew up with religion as a part, with Judaism as a part of my experience. My family went to synagogue before my bar mitzvah. My whole family went to synagogue pretty much every Saturday.
The bar mitzvah was a retirement ceremony?
I wouldn't say it was a retirement ceremony, but I think I got a little bit more sporadic, which was bad.
It's one of those ironies. Bar mitzvahs are meant to be the beginning, but for many they're, for myself included, were largely the end.
It's tough for an American teenager because you have your bar mitzvah and it coincides with this point in your time when you just get so much more work too. And the challenge that you have is like, it's Saturday morning. Are you going to wake up and go to synagogue, or are you going to sleep in till 1 p.m. and gain that sleep that you lost the entire rest of the week? And sleep's like very important to your mental well-being, right? And so I think that was one of the bigger challenges. It's like you just have so many more things asking for your time that it's very easy to deprioritize. And maybe it's something that I regret.
Synagogues could do to bring a teenager out of bed. What do you think synagogues could offer that would be enticing enough and useful enough that, what I get at synagogue is as valuable as my sleep?
We've talked about this before. I think, I continued to go to Hebrew school all the way through the end of 12th grade, which meant on Tuesday evenings after school. And I think one of the reasons why I did that has to do with that the community aspect of Judaism. And we've talked about this before, as Judaism being like a very community-oriented religion. And one of the reasons why I kept going to Hebrew school was the ability to have really fun, interesting conversations about Jewish topics, but with a group of people that I never saw any other time. Mm-hmm. And so in some respect, like that was more existent on Tuesday nights at the synagogue in Hebrew school than it was in synagogue on Saturday mornings.
So you're saying what could draw you someone into being involved is the sense of community and the sense of the conversation. I imagine, maybe I'm wrong, that it's not just the community, because community, while religion is one way to get community, there's many ways of getting community. You can get community at your karate class, you can get community at your cooking class. It must be the conversation is unique. What were the types of conversations you would have that you probably couldn't get anywhere else?
Some of it is just the people that you have them with. But shout out to Guy Ziv, my 11th and 12th grade Hebrew school, one of the two Hebrew school teachers of that period. And Kareth, who is the head of the Hebrew school, who taught a 10th grade Hebrew school class that I was in.
Was the name Kareth? Is that what you said?
Kareth, yeah, who was, and she was, she was awesome. And so in 10th grade, we talked a lot about like Hebrew, like, you know, Jewish topics like Talmud and Gemara. And
so what were some of the topics you covered? Like, well, was discussions or just learning about them?
Yeah, discussions. We would bring in text and we would talk about text and interpretations. Mm-hmm. And I've forgotten some of the specifics, which is too bad, but I have the papers lying around somewhere. I try not to throw away anything. I'm that person. but I just really fantastic conversations that she led, that I think made us all much more thoughtful about Judaism. And then with Guy, we talked a lot about politics, which is fun. And as you're very aware, I am a big fan of talking about politics. I don't know when this is going to come out, but there's an Israeli election coming up. And we would usually talk about politics in both the United States.
And was it politics for the sake of politics or politics as an expression of Jewish faith?
And it was more, I would say, Jewish related politics.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, yeah.
Did God ever come into the conversation? Was there ever a discussion about, is there a God, spirituality? Do you believe in God, or is that something that wasn't talked about?
I wouldn't say it was a big question that came up often. It's because it's something that's so tough for people to talk about, you know.
What makes it tough?
I think everybody has their own sort of interpretation of what God means to them. And when you start getting those, those different interpretations into conflict with each other, people can get very defensive.
What are some of the different interpretations in your mind?
I don't know. You have people, you have people who are very strongly believing in like God as a single individual, and you have people who are more unsure, and you have people who view God as more of a broader phenomenon. And then, you know, you have people who really don't believe in God, you know, and so like there's a very broad spectrum. I don't know. I don't want to put words in other people's mouths because I feel like everybody has their own sort of belief and interpretation of what God means to them. But certainly like when, you know, people always say like, you know, the quickest, you know, you can end a conversation very quickly. You can create a lot of acrimony
isn't that true about most topics? What do you think makes this topic, you know, every topic you can disagree and people can have the conversation. Why is it that we're so stifled in this conversation? Why can't we just have the conversation and talk about intellectually the pros and cons and why yes, why not? And I think especially given that we are on the eve of Passover, which basically the big topic of the conversation of Passover really is not just about freedom for the Jews, but about, is there an interventionalist divine power in the world? That's really what the topic of Passover is in many ways. A lot of people kind of ignore that. And I always love to share with people. Many people think that Passover is about freedom from Pharaoh. And it's kind of missing the point because freedom is really not a topic of conversation on Passover. I always like to share with people, they're surprised that really it's not about freedom. It's really about service. And really all that changes on Passover is we go from serving Pharaoh to serving God. But there was never really any freedom in there. Of course, the depth being that serving God is freedom for us, which is a different conversation that's worth having. But in any case, my point, I think, is clear that what makes talking about God, why can't we just have the conversation?
I think one of the big reasons why it's hard for people is because it's so fundamental to a lot of people's beliefs. God is one of those things that it's a belief system, and that makes it very closely held and very, and a lot of people feel, and I mean, this, you know, this also like leads back to the history of talking about God and society and the way like discussions about religion often go. It becomes a very, you're wrong, I'm right, I need to convince you. If you don't believe me, you're a horrible person. You know, it can become that way very quickly. I don't think it's as true for a lot of topics. And a lot of things people are more capable. I mean, in America, sometimes it becomes that way with politics. But, and I think, you know, it's true for a lot of heavy topics, but it's one of those topics that ends up that way.
So tell me, what is the practical difference of believing in God or not believing in God? Like what does it, you're saying it gets to the core of something very fundamental. What is the difference in how someone lives their life if they believe in God or don't believe in God?
I think in some way it just sort of affects the way you structure your religion and your belief in the way that you're going to go through the world. Like, do you believe that there's someone guiding that, or do you believe that it's sort of up to you to guide yourself and make your own decisions?
And what would be the practical difference there?
Some of it depends on the way you choose to interpret it, because there are many ways to interpret. I don't know, you know, as we've talked about before, that there are many ways to interpret the way that God can influence people's behavior. But, you know, from like more active role to more passive role to like, you know, humans.
So you're saying the biggest difference ultimately is who sets the standard? Is it yourself setting a standard, or yourself basically defining morality for yourself? Or is the standard of morality somehow coming from outside yourself? That was the difference you're trying to point out?
I think, yeah, to some degree, I think it comes back to morality, but in some ways it's also just about, it's about just decisions and, you know, how your life is going to look and what decisions are you going to make about how to act. And some of that does come back to ethics and morality. And it's, you know,
do you think believing in God sets a higher standard or forces people to act better?
I wish I could say that. I don't know if that's necessarily empirically reflected in the history of human civilization. A lot of people who believed in God have done a lot of bad things, but theoretically it could.
And how do you personally think about it? Which side do you fall on, or how do you think about it? What are some of the factors that lead you in one direction or another?
This is definitely something that I'm struggling with a lot right now and thinking about a lot. Is to what degree do I think there is a God, and to what degree do I think that God is involved in the workings of the universe? And I think there are some Jewish interpretations of it that fit relatively well with what sort of rings true to me, which is this sort of God as nature, God as part of everything, you know, God as binding the universe together. But to the degree that I think I'm still sort of responsible for my own person, I think there's a lot of personal responsibility there. Like I think, you know, humans are responsible for doing things in an ethical way themselves.
And you're saying they determine that ethics? Human beings determine that ethics?
Well, to a certain sense, human beings determine our ethics even with the belief in God.
I totally agree.
Do
you think that radar was implanted, or it's just a byproduct of just evolutionary psychology?
I think there's, and I guess to a certain extent, if you believe in God, the evolutionary psychology is part of God's creation. But I don't know if there's necessarily a direct like God to ethics, to morality, to kind of, you know, human behavior connection. I think there's some cultivation of it that's happened by people, in the sense that humans have drawn out their own value systems. Maybe it's hard to say. Okay. I don't know. This is a good question.
How would you come to where it comes from? And when you have a Passover Seder, what's for you, is that a historical event, or it's merely a cultural phenomena? And when you do it,
ooh, this is very interesting, because I feel like it's hard to say, you know, with historical evidence that the Passover story happened in the exact way that it's told. Have you done a lot of
investigation and evidence on both sides?
Personally, I don't know. I haven't gone and done the archaeology, but certainly I've read a little bit about it. But not, you know, I'm not an ex. I wouldn't say I'm an expert, but that doesn't stop me from, when I do the Passover Seder, from treating it like it happened. You know, like I do in some aspects view the story as like a story, like a real story. When you read the Haggadah and you go through and talk about how the Exodus occurs, there's some aspect, and to some degree, one of the beautiful things about the Passover Seder is that it happens in the present tense.
Right. You know, everyone has to look at themselves as leaving Egypt.
It's not this happened. It's what happened to me when I was in Egypt and became free. And to some, in some ways, that sort of very elegantly deals with the whole question of whether it's a true story, whether it's an allegory, because you can treat it as history and also treat it as reality and treat it as happening now, and not having to constantly think, how long ago did this happen? You know, like, who was involved? Like, where is this sort of evidence for this? It's like, it's, you know, like the Seder with its audiovisual aids.
Yep. Of, it's an amazingly
you know, on the table.
Yeah. It's an experience.
It's reenacting this mm-hmm. thing. Yes. It's beautiful. Right.
And I guess, you know, the question is always like, how did the Seder start if it didn't happen? Who made that first Seder that, you know, my grandparents left Egypt, yeah. but they never, you know, how would that even that yeah. phenomenon start if it didn't somewhat happen? You know, it's kind of hard to imagine.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And do you believe that without God, you can have objective meaning? So kind of, this is obviously related to the morality point, but slightly different point. Do you find meaning in life if you don't believe in a God, or do you think you need some form of a God, even your form of a binding agent, which is also a Jewish idea, of course, that we also believe that God sustains the universe every second. So it's not too far off from part of the Jewish conception. Of course, we believe, in addition to other concepts too, is that a crucial dimension of meaning?
I don't think the belief in like God giving you meaning is necessary to have meaning. I think believing in God as part of the world and you as part of the world and you as part of like a broader connection to God's creation and, you know, to God being everywhere is very helpful to creating meaning for yourself. I think that's a very helpful way to think about, you know, you being, your meaning being part of a broader story that's mm-hmm. all connected together. That definitely helps when thinking about, oh, personal meaning. I think on from a different sense of meaning, I think, you know, that I may be somewhat old-fashioned and believing that there's like some objective truth out there that, you know, the academic project and general society tries to strive for. And I think, you know, maybe some of that is also related to God. And historically, academic mm-hmm. inquiry has been inspired by that in a lot of ways. But it's definitely, yeah, I think God is related to those things. I don't know if it's necessary. I don't know if it's a necessary condition, but it's certainly intertwined with the idea of meaning.
Mm-hmm. So yes. You obviously you're still struggling with questions and working through it. That being said, you stay involved. What keeps you involved despite your doubts? And what do you get out of being involved despite your doubts?
Involved as in involved in the Jewish community.
You learn a little bit and that sense.
Well, I still feel very identified with the Jewish tradition. And I think I've had, you know, a lot of background in Jewish practice and Jewish learning over the course of my life that's connected me to the Jewish community. And I think that's all stuff that's very important to my identity and my conception of what's important. And to some extent, right, like we're talking about values, like that's definitely a big part of it and part of my conception of who I am. So what keeps me coming back? It's part of my culture and my history and part of my belief system, you know, even if it doesn't include that exact type of godliness that maybe, you know, some other people have. But I think, you know, it's a complex relationship and it's a beautiful relationship. And so it's something that's very meaningful and something that I appreciate a lot.
Beautiful. And what last
and,
question?
And Torah study, and by the way, Torah study, hold on. And Torah study is very important to that. Like the whole point of the religion, like the beautiful thing about the religion is how much difference of opinion there is and how much study you can do and how much interpretation you can do and how many rabbis there are. And it's one of the things that I think makes Judaism such a strong religion is this dedication to discourse and dedication to learning. That is maybe not necessarily shared, although, you know, a lot of religions have some aspects of that. But like one of the things that I think is so beautiful about Judaism is the way that it encourages you to constantly learn and question your belief about about things. And
no, you know, question about it. That's the name of the Seder game, is questions and developing questions. And that's really at the core of how we start off, is with the question. And really the question is what creates freedom, because it bursts, it creates new paradigms. That's really what a question is meant to do. It's to create new paradigms, and that in a way is what freedom is. Freedom is not being stuck in one paradigm, but creating new ones. That's a part of freedom. So I definitely agree with you on that. And how would you articulate, obviously, would you, you know, you grew up going through Hebrew school to high school, and that obviously you have a warm, fuzzy feeling about that. And that I think is what keeps you connected. Somebody that did not grow up with that level of involvement, what would you share as, you know, a good reason to, as you mentioned, dive into the dialectics of Torah learning and whatnot?
I don't want to be super cliche about it, but I would say it's just really interesting. Sometimes I joke a little bit that Judaism is like English class turned into religion, because you go in and you read text and you do textual analysis, and you talk about it. But in many ways, that's one of the reasons why it's so fun, because you have these really beautiful, I don't know, my synagogue, and the synagogue I go to in DC, I go to the this minyan that's lay-led. It's led by the community. And we have a lot of very, very smart, interesting people in the community. And weekly, you know, different people choose to give the divar. And those people all say very, very interesting things about that you can learn from this, you know, this tradition. And it's very grounded in, you know, the books, the Talmud, and, you know, the history of interpretations, but it's also, you know, it also connects to the present. And so I think one of the things that's great about doing this is you get to consider your own feelings about values and about how you want to exist in the world and about what's meaningful to you. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's meaningful, is that you get this space that we don't always get to evaluate your own beliefs and your own meaning and your own sense of purpose. And that's the draw, you know, like that's what it's really all about.
Right. That time to reflect and clarify for yourself what you really think.
Absolutely.
And how you're going to relate to it.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Well, Sandy, thank you so much for sharing all your interesting thoughts on the topic and your background.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Really appreciate your perspective, and look forward to hearing from you again.
Absolute pleasure being here. Thank you.